She's shined on theater stages, film, and television. In the outfit, she's the ruthless gang leader, Violet LaFontaine, Nikki Amuka-Bird. He won an Academy Award in 2015 for the screenplay of World War Thriller, The Imitation Game, the director and co-writer of the outfit, Grant Moore. You co-wrote the screenplay with John McNeil, who is here and with us tonight, who's not behind the table. Could you tell us how you two got to this story? How did the idea come about?
Yeah, I think for me, in some way, emotionally, this story began with my grandfather, who I was very close to growing up. When I was about 7, my parents split up, and my grandfather, my mom's father, became very active in raising me and my little brother, who's really a father figure to us. He taught me how to tie a tie for the first time. Some of my first experiences of going to a movie theater were with my grandfather, Charlie. He was, I think, the nicest, kindest, most generous man I've ever known. He was a doctor in a small town. And despite being such a kind and decent man, as a doctor, one of his patients was the notorious mobster Jerry Catino. And this was always a subject of conversation in the family. My grandmother would always say to him, you know, how can you treat this vicious killer? And he would always say, oh, well, he was never anything but a gentleman to me. And we would sort of say, yeah, but he's a murderer. I mean, you don't have to do this. And you know, he was really adamant about treating this guy. You could say this, and he was a patient who came through his door, and it didn't matter what he did outside. Once they walked through the doors of his medical practice, they were a patient. And so this wasn't something that it was always rattling around in my head. Like, what must those conversations have been like behind closed doors between my grandfather, this kind, decent man, and this vicious killer in whose service he worked? And so then, cut to many years later, some years back, I was with my dear friend and co-writer Jonathan McLean, and he said to me, you know, no one's ever made a film about a Savile Row dealer before. Is there something there? And I said, yes, that's a great idea. We were both kind of fascinated by this psychology, the psychology of a character who spends his whole life training to do this extremely esoteric and precise, detailed thing that most people don't understand. He makes something so wonderful that most people can't even understand why what he makes is so wonderful. And we were kind of digging around, we kept digging around for a story in which to put the character. We knew we wanted to write about this tailor, but we couldn't figure out what the story around him we wanted to tell was. And then one day, we were looking for a book of the history of tailoring in the 20th century, and we found a single sentence about how, this is true, the first bug the American FBI ever planted in its history was planted in Chicago, Illinois, in 1956, inside a tailor shop. And instantly we both just lit up, sort of going, oh my gosh, this is the story. What if we tell a story about a man like my grandfather, the sort of decent guy who just wants to make these beautiful clothes, but who has to make them in the service of a bunch of vicious killers.
And how did you think of Mark Rylance for the part, and how did you receive the proposition to play?
I mean, I think anyone thinks of Mark Rylance for everything, and for good reason. You know, I don't think they ever dreamed we'd actually get him for this, but he responded right away. It's always funny seeing kind of what actors respond to and what people think are sort of right for them or wrong for them. But we sent it to Mark, and then very quickly he rang up and said, oh yes, I get this, I get why this is cool, and I get why this is cool for me. And he instantly saw why he was so perfect for it. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, he is like Leonard, our tailor, the center of the film. He's this man who's spent his life utterly dedicated to this one extremely specific craft.
Thank you. There was a question?
Hi, this is a question from Brazil. My name is Rodrigo from TV Globo. Two questions, in fact. Your movie is astonishing. The first question, I'd like you to tell a few words about the action scenes in the film. They are really impressive. I'd like you to tell a few words about the editing of those scenes. And the second question is, You are dealing with a genre that has a historical background. If you, we could go from Fritz Lang to the Coen brothers. How to put your own personal signature into a genre that deals with such a brutal chaos like this one? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gosh, it's so difficult to talk about our film at the beginning of any sentence that starts with either Fritz Lang or the Coen brothers. But I'll do my best. I think we knew, we talked a lot about, and you and I talked a lot about, the kind of iconography of noir gangsters from the 40s and 50s, and this idea that we were taking a kind of sort of classic pieces of noir cinema and noir iconography and trying to reimagine, trying to tell them in a new way. So in a way, part of the trick was, can we tell a story about gangsters in the 40s and 50s, of which we've seen a lot, and can we kind of go into their world through a new lens, the lens of this tailor and this tailor shop? Does that allow us kind of a new way of looking at this kind of wonderful classic gangster form? In terms of the action sequences, it's funny to talk about because it was difficult, and some of the editing became very crucial to the sequences, sort of keeping the tension endlessly ratcheting up, because it's funny, for a movie that is, and part of also making the last set of action sequences work really well, just that the sequence of violence work, was keeping the early sequences kind of so gentle and beautiful and pretty in some way. Like, our kind of running joke in some ways about the film was that it starts as Phantom Thread and ends as Reservoir Dogs. And you have to have that first part that's quite kind of lovely to build something that gets as violent as it gets. And I think I take this tribute to the film that it feels as kind of viscerally impactful towards the end as it does, because there are, I believe, 9 gunshots in the entire film. There are literally 9, and our sound team, Ali and Rachel, who I think just got Oscar nominated for No Time to Die for the best, would tell you that they spent a lot of time on the exact sound of each and every one of those 9 gunshots, fewer gunshots than in No Time to Die. But the idea was that because we build them, every single one should feel so impactful and so brutal.
And then one of the things I loved reading the script and being a part of it is that so much of the tension is created from like a battle of wits as opposed to actual rooms of sort of palpable violence. So it feels like a lot more aggressive than you'd expect from people talking.
Yeah, you never even carry a gun.
Yeah,
in
that's
the film.
Right. But it feels like we're actually in a battle having a fight, and I think that's credit to the film for writing.
Well, and to you for being so intimidating. But no, I think it's a big thing, especially because your character enters late in the film. There's so much kind of talking about her before she shows up. There's a lot of weight to carry, and a lot of we talk. It's a lot more interesting, right? That it's, there's a pressure. How do you play someone the audience has heard so much about and yet hasn't seen yet? How do you deal with those expectations? And I think Sherwin, we were talking to you before we were shooting, you were very, very eloquent on the subject.
Because you'd set it up in terms of, like, you almost expect a man to walk in at that point. I made an assumption that this very terrifying figure was going to walk in, and in my head, that person doesn't look like a woman, and she doesn't look like me. It does help to have 2 very big body parts at all times. But I had this feeling that if she was really that intimidating, she wouldn't have to play that, she wouldn't have to pretend to be intimidating, she wouldn't have to be aggressive. It was just like the click of a finger and she could make something happen. And you very generously let me play with that. Yes, yeah. I felt like it's the right move. Yes.
Hello, and thanks a lot for a great work. It was an intellectual delight, I would say. And my question is, maybe primarily to Graham, but also to Nikki. This person, so the tailor, the main character, as you said, he has to compromise to some extent, so he has to deal with these criminals on a regular basis in order to make his art and to be able to make the poses he wants. From your perspective as a also screenplay writer and creator of this story. Is it sort of in the art a big reason enough to, yeah, to sort of forget for a moment who you are dealing with? Because with your grandfather it was a bit different. He could have been a doctor even without treating this person. But in this case it was more sort of codependency or dependency. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's exactly right. That was something that we thought about a lot. I was really interested in this idea of complicity. We all go through the world, and we try to be decent people, we try to be kind people, we try to be generous people. And at the same time, we know there are monsters out there. And we know that we participate in systems, in business systems, in governmental systems in which there are monsters. And we all have to make decisions for ourselves about when we become complicit in that. At what level of involvement are we no longer just a bystander to something awful, but are we really tacitly supporting it? And that's what's so compelling to me about a character like Leonard at the center of the film. He's someone, I think, who, when he begins the film, he wants to lock himself up in his little tailor shop and make beautiful things and not care about the outside world at all. He does not want to think even a little bit about the violence and the horror of the real world outside. And yet, as in the real world, the violence and horror that's outside keeps knocking on his door. And this happens to all of us. I think the real world, I mean, we've all just lived through 2 years of a global pandemic, right? Like, the real world keeps knocking on our door. We can shut ourselves up and pretend that it's not there. But at what point do we have to say, no, we're a part of this. We are a part of the systems that we all work in together. And at what point do you sort of become close enough to monstrousness that you either become a monster yourself, or you say, no, this will not stand. I will no longer continue to participate in this system.
And how did you handle with Matt Ryan's the fact that his psychological progression through the story is very, very sudden and gradual? The back and forth, the shooting was, it was not chronological,
Yeah, so we shot completely in order. I think something tremendously important to all of us to begin shooting the first scene and the last scene, with a couple shots sort of here and there, stolen away. And I think that really allowed us to, in some ways what it allowed us to do is actually improvise a little bit more and change things on the fly a little bit more, because we knew that if we changed something on day 4 of shooting, we weren't locked into a payoff for that later in the film. We could make changes later on. The film got to evolve as the performances evolved, as the characters evolved, as we all worked on. At the same time, I know that something we talked with Mark a lot about was, you know, every character in the film has sort of side of themselves they present to the world, and then there's something else going on underneath them, right? The film's called The Outfit. It's about the versions of ourselves that we present to the world, and then what's underneath. I'm wearing a suit right now because I'm trying to say something. We all put on these things. We put on these things outside of us to communicate something to the outside world. What are we trying to say, and what's behind that that we're trying to cover up? And so with every character, there's always this question of what is he or she thinking and feeling right now, and how much of that do we want the audience to actually know? And especially with Mark's performance, we talk about this a lot, even saying sometimes before takes, you know, how much do you want to know about what I'm actually feeling right now? 10%, 80%, 40%, you know, we sort of calibrate it that way. Because I think every character in the film, over its course, starts to reveal more and more of themselves.
Listening to you, it's nice to feel like you had the space or the freedom to make the film how you needed to make it. Maybe it's opportunity to salute the producers who are in the room with us, Amy Jackson, Ben Browning, and Scott Wasserstein. Did they, to what extent did they help you create also the space like you imagine it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel Extremely grateful to our producers, Ben and Amy, who are sitting over there. I got to make exactly the film I wanted to make. And I don't know of a lot of other first-time filmmakers who have the privilege of being able to say that. You know, it was, did we have all the money in the world? We did not. Did we have all the time in the world? We did not. But we had what we needed. And what we had was the understanding that if we all really believed in something, and we really believed in what we were doing, and we could fight for it, then we'd be allowed to do it.
And at what point did you decide that it was going to be in a single location? Does it have anything to do with the pandemic, or is it just independent from that? And the story required it in your mind and Jonathan's?
Yeah, it's funny. Jonathan and I had never planned on shooting this film in the middle of a global pandemic, as much as I think anyone a few years ago really imagined that we'd be living through something like this. We found, sort of, in early drafts, we got very excited about this idea. At first, it was just this experiment. You know, what if we tried doing a draft for a multi-space trailer shop? What would happen there? We did a draft, we never left the shop, and instantly we both got really excited, because it felt to us what could have been kind of filmmaking gimmick instead turned into a method of bringing us emotionally and psychologically closer to our protagonist. The camera doesn't leave the shop because the lead character doesn't leave the shop. We only see what he sees, we only hear what he hears, we only go where he goes. And so in some great way it felt like actually the confinement of space rather than being limiting was freeing, because it allowed her
it
allows
deeper emotional access to your
early
character.
Thank you. There's
another
question?
My name is Mahari Sabin, African-American Venus. Thank you, because this is really an American noir with really language that is really British, I can say. So I want to know how you managed to do this. And the second is, you were always talking about La Fontaine. I'm inside of this box state, you know, because I go to podcast with Francesas and so. There was no French white, so I always thought it was a black American. No, because then she said it at the end of the film, but I never expected the woman to come out. So that was really great. That makes the film perfect also.
Well, thanks. Yeah, we, the different question was about, I think, American noir and the American dialogue, and that was important to us. It was, you know, this is inspired by a true story. There was, as I was saying, the first bug the FBI ever planted was inside this tailor shop in Chicago, Illinois, in 1956, and so we very early on had this idea of it, wanting to write about someone who cut on Savile Row, someone who kind of been in the guts of these great old tailor shops making these clothes, which meant that he was most likely an Englishman who was confining himself in America for some reason, and then kind of fish out of water cultural context. It was really interesting to us, especially in the 50s, especially this time when lots of folks were coming to America to find their fortune, find their way in the world. It felt like this place where a cutter might go to start over again. In the same way, La Fontaine is based on a real woman named Stephanie St. Clair, who was a gangster in New York, actually, moved her to Chicago for dramatic purposes, but who similarly was born in Haiti and managed to find her way to the United States and built, I mean, Nikki can talk about this massive criminal empire.
Yeah, I hadn't even known that this woman existed, and she had such an extraordinary life, and I like you, when I was reading the script, I was thinking the same thing. This is definitely a man. She had huge hardship in her life. You know, when she immigrated to America, she was homeless, she was prostituting, she was raped, abused, Ku Klux Klan, everything. And her way of overcoming that was to develop this kind of core of steel where she had absolutely no fear of anyone, man or woman. And she just became really defiant, and her way of, she always wanted to be a lady and to have nice things and to live the life of wealth and success, and this was her route, and I just found that really fascinating. It also made her human to me, and not just a killer, you know. It was like a way for me to find her vulnerability as well, which was easier than just making
sociable.
Well,
because she's not a sociable, and we can't talk about this. I don't think she is. She's a businesswoman.
Completely. And that idea of being a queen and being regal and refined was a very defiant idea for a black woman at that time. So, yeah, she's a kind of revolutionary in some ways. The wrong way.
Your entrance in the film is quite spectacular and intimidating.
Right.
Was it something you shot a number of times? Was there a lot of takes?
No, it was, it is also intimidating to go into a room and work with generally some of my heroes and, work opposite Mark Rylance, and I've been watching him and Simon Russell Beale. These are people that I followed since I was a drama student. And so it did take me a little time to warm up, but shooting chronologically as we did, I remember Graham just having moments going, how do I? And just needing to exhale, and also Mark being so generous with his expertise, and it being a truly collaborative experience. Very quickly, I found my feet, because she comes in and she has to hit a certain energy. Like, there's no, you can't underplay that, you can't overplay that. But it became more and more exhilarating to find that confidence. By the end of the shoot, I wanted to just like do all that.
Yes.
Me again. Crime stories, especially noir stories, they reinvent the concept of hero, villain, things like this. But I would like to hear from you both the idea of good and evil, and specifically the word hero. How would you just apply those words to define the Englishman and to define Michael Caine?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think something I love about the tradition of noir filmmaking is that it is morally complicated, and the characters are forced to make impossible moral decisions. So it was really born from this, I think noir filmmaking was born from this post-war period in the middle of the last century, where people were sort of questioning, what's the point of it all? Why are we here? What are we doing? In impossible times, what are moral decisions and what are immoral decisions? And I really love that. And I think that this is a film that doesn't, we were talking earlier about clothes, and I think this is a film that presents to you a set of characters who you think you have a take when you first see them. You think these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, these are the smart people, these are the dumb people, these are the complicated people, these are the simple people. And within a few minutes, every character in the film, I think, reveals him or herself to be more complicated than they initially presented themselves. And that was tremendously important to me, that people who seemed like they were on the side of angels might not be quite so angelic after all. And then other people who seemed sort of nefarious turned out actually to be reading what was going on pretty accurately if you go back and think about it. And so part of the goal, especially for a film like this, which is a lot of twists and turns, is to create something that would reward future viewings. That once you've seen it, you can go back and see it again, and decisions the characters make have different moral weight in light of what you know about where they'll end up. That, I always think that something you want to, the goal is to make this film that would reward not just one viewing, but two, three.
This was a really interesting, because in a way you could say that everything is in the story, if you want to look at it. So you're asking the audience to find the queen empathy, and that means that they then have to get within themselves, and that's usually exciting to play as an actor, but I think it's a great question that we're all asking ourselves right now. As you said, it's like, where is my moral code and center? Why am I drawn to these people? And framing it in this large, stylish, seductive way makes it even more enticing as to which side of the line you stand on.
We're running out of time, but I'd love to hear about those shears. Beautiful, big shears. They're also used on the poster.
Those are real. Those came from Huntsman on Savile Row. Those are the shears that Mark cuts with, are real shears that we borrowed from Cutter on Savile Row that have been used for years. It was really important to us to make everything in the shop feel real. So many of the props actually came from Savile Row. So much of the design came from time we spent beneath Cutter shops, watching how these things were made, so that every prop felt real, or this design felt like something that would actually happen. Mark spent some time training beneath a real Savile Row shop to learn how to use these tools and make all these things. I think that was part of inviting the audience into the kind of luxurious richness of this world.